Welcome back to episode 7 of Solving Systems.
Hello, everyone. Yeah, welcome back.
Today we've got an exciting topic for you guys.
Very exciting. Very
Jackson exciting. And I always say after every episode that this has been our favorite episode so far. I think I'm going to say before the episode this time that this is going to be the best one.
Nice, nice. Shameless promotion. Yes. Very good. Very good.
I don't know why we're really promoting it because we're already listening.
Yeah, right? If you're still with us by episode 7, I feel like you're one of our diehards. So,
yeah.
So yes, welcome back. We don't need to convince you. Let's dive right in.
Right. So today we're talking about voting theory.
Interesting.
To some of our listeners who have heard a little bit about this in the past, it might be a boring subject, but we're going to try to spice it up. There's a lot of interesting math behind a lot of the things we're going to talk about, which I think will allow us to give a different perspective on some of these topics.
So before our listeners go big eye roll talking more about politics, why don't you give them a little bit of the background, Nikhil, of just why we're talking about this system and how it's not really a partisan issue per se, mm-hmm. For the most part, but rather just why you might like to examine this system.
Right. So when we go and vote, we vote in a very simple way usually. Right, we just go and bubble who we like the best. That's it. We don't give much thought as to the process that actually selects them. Right, and this year, or at least in the last election, we did see some uproar over the primary system.
Mm-hmm.
But no one really questions the entire voting process, not just the primaries, but also the final ballot that we submit on November 8th or whatever.
It seems pretty simple. If you have two people, you pick the one you like the most.
Right.
Okay.
But there are a lot of problems even with just that.
Sure.
And the process that selects those two people, the fact that there aren't just two people on the ballot in the end, there's so many parts of this system that often go unexamined.
Sure. So when you look at it, most of us think, okay, who am I going to vote for in the upcoming whatever the race is? Am I going to pick candidate A or B? Right? And that's the only choice that we really think about. We don't think necessarily about, is there a candidate C? Is there a candidate D? Are there more parties? Are there more people? So in a purely, do I like black or white better, A or B better, picking one or the other seems to be the simplest and most straightforward way. But there might be some flaws with that.
Right. So when you have two candidates, it's simple how you should vote, right?
Sure.
Like, you can only choose one of the two. It's very clear one person's going to get more than 50%.
Sure.
That meets our fundamental assumptions about how voting should work, right?
Yes.
But then, when you add more candidates, more parties...
More parties? More parties? We can't have more parties, can we?
I mean...
Some places do.
So, the problem is that from a game theory math perspective, you really shouldn't have more than two.
Sure.
So this is where we start getting into... And we'll stay light on the math here. It's just more conceptual.
Sure.
But when you have more parties... Right. Once you add three parties,
mm-hmm.
You hear the argument often in modern politics that you're no longer voting for a candidate, you're voting against a candidate.
A la the recent French election.
For example.
Yes.
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 And so the interesting thing, though, is in the French election, they had a runoff, which
yes.
is something we'll talk about later.
Sure.
And they went into a one versus one election where you couldn't vote for a third candidate.
Right.
So they eliminated... I don't want to use this term, but voter stupidity, I guess.
Sure.
In voting for a third-party candidate that isn't going to win.
Yes.
But how the American system works is we give the voters freedom to vote for whoever they want in the final round.
Yes.
If they made it that far,
mm-hmm.
If they went through their party's process, then they should be allowed to be on the ballot. That's fine.
Sure.
So it's up to the voter to realize, right?
Yes.
When you have three candidates, one of whom is expected to get like 5%,
yes.
and the other two that are batting around 50,
mm-hmm.
your vote for a third-party candidate mathematically just doesn't help,
sure.
right?
Sure.
You're voting based on principle, and that's a fine reason to do it.
Yes.
But when we talk about the actual voting system, the problem with the system is that it doesn't allow these third-party candidates to actually have a real chance at winning. Because everyone goes into an election with the assumption that one of the two candidates will win.
So now we're talking Bush v. Gore.
Right.
Yeah, and Ralph Nader, who a lot of people voted for, specifically in Florida, right? And the argument by the sort of Democratic establishment was a vote for Nader is a wasted vote. And you're essentially throwing your vote away. And this is something that I think a lot of in-tune political people are sort of... hearing more and more, right, that that in this last election, the 2016 presidential election, a vote for Gary Johnson was a vote for someone else. A vote for Jill Stein was a vote for somebody else. And it does seem to, when you sort of phrase it in that way, squeeze out those third-party candidates.
Right, because what's important to remember is that even if you're voting for Ralph Nader, right, as your first choice, mm-hmm. between Gore and Bush, you might have had a preference.
You might have.
And most likely you did.
Probably.
Right? And one of the voting systems we're going to talk about later allows you to actually rank the candidates.
Interesting.
And so you could put Ralph Nader at first, knowing that if he doesn't get enough votes, you're... preference between Nader and, or between Gore and Bush will be considered.
Yes.
Something I just pulled up, something relevant to what we're discussing. The 1998 Minnesota gubernatorial election.
Interesting. That was a pretty famous election, was it
that
not?
One,
I
right?
do, yes.
Let's see, was I born then? No, I was a month out at that point.
I was 15 years old.
So
just entering the entrance. Yeah, yes.
So, Johnson, do you want to retell what happened, or should I give you the numbers?
Why don't you give me the numbers, and I'll give you my recollection
of
the events.
I'll just give you the straight percentages, and you can tell me
what
happened.
Here we go.
36.99.
Yes.
34.29. And 28.09.
Wow. Okay. So those are three percentages, which most of our listeners will recognize as being less than 50%.
Mm-hmm.
And in what can only be described as a stunning and remarkable turn of events, Jesse Ventura, the former wrestler, the former bodybuilder, was elected the governor of Minnesota. And I can't even, honestly, I can't even remember who the other, the mainstream candidates were, Democrat, Republican. Go ahead.
Norm Coleman and Skip Humphrey.
Oh.
Both had big names.
They did, yes. Big names in Minnesota. And actually, Norm Coleman ended up,
he was a senator.
Yeah, U.S. senator.
Right.
And Skip Humphreys, I think, grandson or related to Hubert Humphrey. Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
He was an attorney general.
So,
in the statewide office. Yeah.
So only in Minnesota, they say, could a candidate from a third party with little to no institutional backing and policies which were very rough around the edges come out and actually win the election. Now, what was the percentage that Jesse Ventura actually attained?
Just shy of 37.
Okay, so roughly a third, or slightly over a third, of people who cast their ballots voted for Jesse Ventura. Interesting, if the systems were changed, would he still have been governor?
So the question then is, did he have 50% of the people that would have preferred him over one of the two mainstream candidates?
I think it's fair to say that, and I don't know the exact numbers, obviously, but going back to his polling, very, very immediately into his governorship, his poll numbers were not high. And it wasn't necessarily based on any policy positions or shifts that he made. It was just he really didn't have that much support from the general population. He had a very dedicated group of people who went to vote for him. But you could see that if there were some sort of a ranking system, there were a lot of people who considered him to be their last choice.
I don't want to say this is familiar, but this is familiar.
This does sound vaguely familiar. Just anyone who follows politics, earning a sizable enough minority to win an election, especially in a primary type setting, is relatively familiar, I think, to the American population right now.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's still happening, and the question is, does it really represent the will of the voters? And that's what a voting system should do and represent. And our question today, overarching, will be, do we have the most effective system for doing this? Mm-hmm. And we'll throw out some ideas as far as other ways we could look at it.
Yeah, you mentioned primaries, right? Not to talk too much about modern politics.
Sure.
But this election did expose a lot of the problems in the primaries.
Yes.
What you mentioned with the Republican side having a very fractured field.
Yes.
And then on the Democratic side, there were questions about how the system should be set up.
Sure.
In terms of... party insiders having more influence or less,
absolutely,
right?
Yep.
And so these conversations were happening this year, mm-hmm. and I think it's possible we'll see changes in the near future to these systems.
Yes.
It's important to remember that these systems did develop pretty recently.
Sure.
The modern primary system has only been around since, I believe, the 70s.
Not that long.
So not that long, right. Before that, it used to be party insiders that controlled everything.
Yeah.
And that brings up different questions about what people are looking for in candidates, right? In past times, it would be the candidate that could negotiate the best and, you know, formed that coalition within the party.
Sure.
And now it's become more of a campaigning sort of thing.
Absolutely.
But regardless of how you look at it, there are various problems with the primaries that I think everyone agrees with.
Yeah.
One of them being a lower turnout. It's the ones that happen, you know, on a Tuesday a few weeks before the election.
Sure.
Those are the ones that have low turnout and just frankly aren't real indicators of what the people want. Right, it's just what the dedicated
sure
group wants.
Yeah, so the counter argument probably would be to that. Well, if I am that dedicated, then I am going to go out when, you know, maybe only 10-15% of the voting population is going to go vote. That just means that my candidate should have a leg up. But that's not the only issue I think with the current system that we have. I mean, when you have primaries or general elections that are so spread out amongst the candidates that we could have theoretically two people in a runoff who are getting, well, let's take the French election, for example. You could have theoretically had two candidates with, let's say, 11 and 10% who go to a runoff. Now, would they have been the two candidates in the 1v1 situation? Possibly, if there had been a different system, but possibly not. But if only 11% of a population is really behind one candidate as their first choice, shouldn't we also consider who that person's second choice and third choice and fourth choice were? I think it's an interesting way to look at it, and it might give us a more representative snapshot of what the public really wants during those primaries or during those caucuses or whatever we might be doing. It's at least worth exploring, mm-hmm. I would say.
One interesting personal example was I was part of, I wasn't running in this election, but it was a group I was a part of
sure.
In the past few months that had an election, mm-hmm. right? And the two people who ended up, you know, receiving the title that was being put up for election
sure.
together had only 40% of first choice votes.
So two separate people combined right. had only 40%.
Combined had only 40%, yes.
Wow. But let me guess, they had the most votes.
Yeah, of course.
Of course.
Because otherwise it wouldn't be fair.
Right, right. So, yeah, so then the question is that fair?
Well,
is it representative of what the will of that body was?
So the thing is, some election like that will be viewed as legitimate, right?
Absolutely.
Because people say, oh, they got the most votes, here's proof.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And that's the most fundamental way we have in our democracy of determining if somebody won or not, who has yes. the most votes, right?
Sure, yep.
But as happened in that election, regardless of who you wanted to win, it was clear there were a lot of hurt feelings because
yes.
people didn't feel like the two individuals represented the group.
Sure.
And I think on a much bigger scale, mm-hmm. this raises some questions. So like in Virginia, and we'll throw this in the show notes, I believe there was an election where a mayor won with 20% of the vote or something very small.
Wow.
Is yeah. that really fair?
No. Does it represent the will of the people? Or is that person earning that 20% strongly disliked by 80% of the other people, and yet those other five candidates maybe fracture the rest of the vote? Maybe they represent pockets of interests within a community that just don't align into a coalition. The other thing I think it brings up is, does it lead to, we already struggle with people feeling like their votes don't matter, mm-hmm. right? If we have a system that further disenfranchises people by saying, well, you have to vote for someone just because we can't have this person win, that's not a great reason that's going to drive people who are already slightly indifferent to voting into the voting booths, right? If I'm going to vote because I really believe in Ralph Nader, let's say, I'm highly likely to go vote because I believe in what he is representing. If I have to go vote for someone else just so that a worse person doesn't get in, that is not great incentive for me to go vote. So I think it's very important that the system that we create is, quote, fair, right? Whatever that means, fair, but also encourages people to say, yes, it's fair, but you can still feel like your preference can be heard.
Right.
Right?
We want to have a system that allows you to vote for third parties
yes.
without affecting the actual result.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And
voter turnout in the United States isn't that good.
No.
And people always say switching to a more complicated system will reduce turnout. But I honestly believe it'll increase turnout, because then you can actually express your view that is different from the norm.
Yes.
Right? People, the 40, 50, 60% who don't go and vote, at least some of them aren't voting because they don't like the choices.
Exactly.
Apathy in this election was extremely high.
Very high.
Why do you think that was? Because, partly at least, because the choices weren't that great for many people.
For many people.
And so to have the ability to vote for a third candidate without influencing, or without even being called out for it.
Right.
Like, even earlier in this episode, I, said that voting for a third party is not exactly the smartest thing to do. It's because our system sucks.
Right.
Because you have to.
Yes. It particularly disenfranchises those third party candidates.
Right.
Right. So it's not that our system is totally flawed. I mean, we have what you would consider free elections. I've never felt intimidated going in to vote, more or less. I think most people would agree that well, there are some laws that are coming out that are making it harder to vote, but more or less, you don't see a lot of reports of huge voter fraud. You don't see systems breaking down on wide scales. And it happens, of course, which is never good. But I think most people agree that we've got the ability to hold fair and free elections, if that's something we care about. It's the fair part that I think we need to tackle here. Is maybe there are different systems and that are currently being used effectively that we could think about employing, at least on a small scale, to maybe make our elections a bit more representative, a bit more fair for all of the candidates involved. And therefore, maybe increasing voter engagement, voter turnout. And I think we would all agree that the more people vote, the more engaged citizens are, the better our democracy works. And isn't that the goal of our voting system in general, is to put people in place who are going to represent our interests?
Right. There's no validity to any system when one person votes.
No.
Right. It depends on at least half the population voting to give it legitimacy. Right.
Exactly.
It's a sort of quorum.
Yeah.
Of sorts, I guess.
Yeah. If I mean, we can do the math. If 50% of the vote goes to a candidate A, but only 40% of the people voted, that's 20% of the population, really, who voted for candidate A. Can they claim a sweeping mandate? They can. Is it accurate? It's debatable.
Well, I mean, like in the last election, right, the current president got, 60-some million votes?
Sure.
And there are 300-some million people in the country?
20%.
Right.
Yep.
So, sure, it's a larger percentage of the people eligible to vote.
Sure.
But it's still a very small amount of people relative. It's 1 out of 5, right?
Yeah.
1 out of 5 people voted for the current president.
Well, and not that we have to tear off the scab for some people, but an even higher percentage of the people voted for the other candidate.
So to address the elephant in the room here.
Sure.
Let's talk about the Electoral College.
Yeah, okay.
There are a lot of arguments on both sides
for
this, and a lot of them came out after this election.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go on the record and say I wrote something before the election.
Okay, okay. So you're
I'm
ahead
not
of the curve
here.
Okay.
Now,
yep.
We'll throw it in the links, the description here. But I actually wrote about a system to get rid of the Electoral College that has been, talked about for a long time,
mm-hmm.
and is currently in the works of coming to realization. But before we talk about that, I think we should talk about what the problems are here.
Sure.
In the system.
So first of all, enlighten our listeners as to the Electoral College. Why do we even have it in the first place?
So it goes back to the founding of this country.
Yes.
Right. And there are a lot of reasons that historians speculate as to why the system came about. Part of it was that the leaders at the time didn't trust the people to make an informed decision. That's one argument always thrown around.
Yep.
Another one is to preserve slavery and slavery institutions.
Mm.
Various reasons about that. And so all of these things were reasons in the past, but now with our more, with our different visualizations of what democracy should look like,
sure.
Now a lot of people question it on the basis of violating one person, one vote. Right.
Wow, that's,
Because your vote in New Hampshire means a lot more than your vote in California.
Yes.
Also, if you are a Republican in California, you are helping the Democrats, right? Because what you're doing is you're increasing the number of votes that California gets.
Yes.
And those votes are going for the Democrat regardless.
Yes.
So if a whole bunch of Republicans move to California, mm-hmm. but not enough to tip California to become a Republican state.
They're helping.
They're helping because yes. they might change that 55 electoral votes into 60.
Yes.
For the Democrats, yes. right? So there's so many problems here. And on top of that, we all complain about gerrymandering, but the Electoral College is gerrymandering by random state lines.
And gerrymandering right? is the sort of, what would we say, the random-ish sort of drawing of congressional lines.
Well, very not district random. Lines.
Of
That's
course.
The important part here.
And generally, right. they are gerrymandered by the party in power.
Mm-hmm.
Is it at the state level?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, when we're talking about real gerrymandering, yeah.
Sure. So at the state level, basically I, quote, arbitrarily draw district lines to basically influence the results of certain districts.
Right, you're right. like packing certain voters together.
Yep.
And doing bad things, I guess.
Sure.
At least things that a lot of us would consider wrong.
Yes.
Actually, a really interesting article I read, and this will also be in the show notes, a Washington Post article from after the election, said that if two state borders had been drawn just a little differently, right, shifting four counties from one state to another,
yeah,
Hillary Clinton would have won.
Wow.
It just
Four counties.
That's all it takes to change the election.
Wow. And that's within the current Electoral College system.
Yeah.
Wow.
So if, you know, if state lines were drawn a little differently, and I mean, of course, that would have probably changed how the election played out.
Sure.
But four counties being shifted in the current 2016 map that we have.
Wow.
To look at, yeah.
Wow. So the question is, and then, of course, you know, our new president comes in and claims a mandate, and he's... and as every president right. tends to do, of course. But the question is, does the result really reflect the will of the people? Is it, quote, fair?
Well, so I'm going to make a counterpoint here.
Sure.
I think it is. It's fair by what we defined it to be, right? I know some of our listeners might be mad if I say this, but I think it's important to note that the Electoral College does have a valid purpose. And that's to preserve legitimacy.
Sure.
Right? We've been doing this, you know, we've been using the system for 240 years now?
Yeah, ballpark.
And it gains legitimacy, it gives legitimacy to the government because of its history.
Sure.
Right? And so changing the system, while it may be better in the long run, or it may appeal to our democratic senses now.
Yes.
It does raise the question that if we change it, are we undermining a system that has, you know, held up for a long time?
Yeah. No, there's definitely a point to be made for that. And then there's also, again, I don't want to, you know, burn too many of our listeners here, but within the system, you know, people will say, well, you know, Hillary Clinton won more votes. She should have been the president. She's a popular vote winner. Well, that's not the rules of the game.
Right.
It's like in a hockey game where, well, we had more shots. We had more shots on goal, so we dominated the game. How many did you put in the net? That's the question, mm-hmm. right? The rules are not to be changed within the middle of the game or at the conclusion of the game as you see fit, but rather, if we want to measure a win in a hockey game by how many shots you put on net, okay, if that's how we define fair, fine. But under the current system... it's fair to say that the current president was victorious and legitimate.
Yes.
I don't think there are too many questions about that. So, yes, I think under the current system, I think it is legitimate. The question is, can the system be changed? Can the system be changed going forward to achieve a more effective election, a more effective voting system for our population? To say... You know what? We heard a lot in this last election about, I don't like either of the candidates.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were various polls out saying, given candidate A, candidate B, and neither would have won. Okay, then our voting system does not do anything to represent the will of those people, right? Especially when you have primaries set up the way they are to be controlled either by large parties or where it's really fractured in the Republican side, so many candidates representing so many interests and yet unable to build a coalition outside of the current president who won that system. But could there be a better way?
Yeah, and so speaking of changing systems here, right? The thing I mentioned earlier about the Electoral College, there is a real proposition that avoids a constitutional amendment. Okay. And that's the important part here, because doing something like that would be very difficult.
Absolutely.
So if people are serious about getting rid of the Electoral College, this is probably the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And what would have to happen is 270 electoral votes worth of states have to all agree to give their votes to the person who wins the popular vote.
I see.
So this is complicated.
Yes. So would this happen at a state level?
Yeah. So what has to happen is, let's take, let me think of a state that's done this. California has done this.
Okay.
So what California did is their state house, their state senate, and then their governor all signed off on this bill that says that once 270 electoral votes worth of states have signed off on it too, then this interstate compact goes into effect.
Interesting.
Right? And then it binds all of these states to give their electors to the winner of the popular vote.
I see.
And this should be legal because it's up to the states to determine who win their state's electors.
Mm-hmm.
It's not dependent on who wins within the state. They can use whatever system they want.
Sure.
And so this idea, it's called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. It's been floating around for a while.
Okay.
It picked up some steam, I think, in the late 2000s, early 2010s. You know,
okay.
Recently.
Yeah.
And then I think it's, you know, going to pick up steam again following this election.
Sure.
But the problem is hitting 270 electoral votes worth of states is very difficult.
Sure.
Because there are not that many states that have a Democratic trifecta, and Democrats seem to be more in favor of this, especially given the last election.
Of course.
What's interesting is that before the last election, back when I wrote about this anyway, it was bipartisan.
Yes.
You know, the memories of 2000 had faded. Mm-hmm. People were like, this system is dumb, let's get rid of it, right?
Yes.
Democrats still favored it a little bit more, probably because of 2000, who knows?
Sure.
But right after the election,
yes,
Republican support for the Electoral College went up. And you can't.
No.
It makes sense, right?
Yes.
If the system favors your side, you want the system.
Of course.
Duh.
Of course.
And changing a system is much harder than keeping it. But there exists a real way to get around what some consider to be a problem. And
sure.
So we may see more talk about this in the future.
Now, so a counterpoint to that, and back to something you said earlier, was, does this take away some of the legitimacy in the eyes of some of our voters? I think there's a fair argument to be said for yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that can be a dangerous thing for some of the elements within our population who already feel like the system is rigged, who already feel like, it's stacked against, the cards are stacked against us. And so I think not that we necessarily need to fully appeal to that way of thinking, but I think it's going to be very important that if this system is changed, that it is as clearly legitimate as possible. Because let's say I live in, Oklahoma, and Oklahoma goes 80-20, no, that's high, 70-30,
mm-hmm.
For a given Republican person, which is probably likely.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, candidate B, Democratic candidate, wins the popular vote, therefore goes on to win the election. We've been relatively fortunate that we haven't had too many elections where we've had people sort of uprising and creating havoc, although we saw a little bit of that here recently.
Mm-hmm.
I think we would have some serious threats to the foundations of our democracy in that situation if someone felt like the election was legitimately stolen from them. So would that be enough to appease those folks? A pact formed by a group of states, while it may pass legal muster, I don't know if for some elements of the population would pass the sniff test of that's fair, right? That seems right. That seems fair. And largely just because we're so used to the system that we have now,
right,
that it would be tough for people to get over that, that, wait, hold on, so this person would have won this many electoral votes, and now they're not, you know, they would have won 285 electoral votes, and now they're not going to win the election? That doesn't seem right. So it's at least something to consider.
And then there's the argument about legitimacy that when you win the Electoral College, it tends to magnify the differences. So sure. If you won 54 to 46, that doesn't sound that great.
Right.
But 335 to 200 and whatever the difference is.
Crushing.
That's huge, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And so I think there's a lot of sides to this legitimacy argument.
Absolutely.
But I think whenever you change a system, you have to be careful.
Absolutely.
What the perception will be.
People are largely comfortable, like you said, with what we've always done. Right? So we've always done this, and it's worked, so why do we need to change? And number two, this is working for me and my party or my group. Why would we change it? Right. So if you're in power and it's working for you, you are far less likely to want to change it, of course. So getting over that hump might be difficult, but I think at least examining the possibilities is definitely worth the time.
Right. So let's examine some possibilities.
Sure.
There are a whole bunch of suggestions as to how we can change how we vote.
Right? Okay.
And I want to start off, before we talk about these, to talk about something from PureMap that's actually relevant here.
Okay.
I don't know if you can call it PureMap, but whatever.
Okay.
It's called Arrow's Impossibility Theorem.
Okay, explain.
And the idea here is, without getting into those details, that given some certain basic assumptions about how we expect our preferences to behave,
okay,
there will never be a perfect voting system.
For example?
So, for example, we expect that if A beats B and B beats C, then our expectation is that in any election, A should also beat C.
Sure.
Right?
Absolutely.
That's one assumption.
Yes.
There are other assumptions like this. Just like common things we expect, right?
Yes.
Like if A gets 51% of first choice votes, they should win.
Yes.
Right? Basic things like that.
Yes.
The thing is, when you take all of these basic things and put them together, there is no voting system that guarantees all basic conditions will be held, no matter how the vote plays out.
Sure.
So the idea here is that every system will have some problems, and we just have to pick one that has the fewest.
Sure. And not only the fewest, but the ones that seem the least maybe dangerous or disenfranchising.
Right.
Right.
And it's also important to pick ones that people can understand.
Yes.
And I think that's an important point here that underlies our entire discussion.
Yes.
As to, you know, when we talk about legitimacy, as we did earlier, these systems that are being changed need to have easy explanations.
Yes.
You need to be able to go to 90-95% of the American population and say, this is why we're changing it, and this is why the current system is, or why the new system will be better.
Yes. And, right? And just a funny side note, I was talking to my wife about this last night, and just, you know, what we were going to be speaking about today on a recording, and as I was bringing up these various systems, she said, yeah, Jake, that's not going to work. I said, well, what do you mean? She said, well, no one's going to understand those. So I think it needs it. If on small scales or on grand scales, governments are going to go ahead with some of these things, there obviously needs to be a voter education program. There needs to be a system of almost grassroots support of people saying, this is why we're doing this, and it makes perfect sense.
So it's great that you mentioned grassroots support, because in Minneapolis and St. Paul, they actually changed their voting system for city council members.
Mm.
And they switched to what we're about to discuss, instant runoff voting.
Okay.
And in doing so, I think this happened about 5 years ago, but that required the voters to vote on this, so they had to become educated, right?
Yep.
And what's cool is that both of these cities came up with ballots that are really, really simple.
Okay.
And the idea behind instant runoff voting is that you vote for your first choice like you normally do. That's what an election is, right?
Sure.
You go to the polls and you vote for your first choice.
Yes.
But you also vote for your second choice and your third choice. And how the ballots are set up is it just asks you, who's your first choice? All right, if they can't win, who's your second choice? And if neither of those two can win, who's your third?
Wow.
You feed that into, electric machine. Whatever.
Sure. Wrong Scantron.
But yeah.
Yep.
You get it.
Yep.
And how that works is it tallies everyone's first choice vote. Okay. Right?
Yep.
The candidate with the least number of first choice votes is eliminated.
Okay.
But all the people who voted for them first also expressed a second choice.
Yes.
So now it's as if that candidate didn't even run in the first place.
Ah.
And their second choice votes.
Yes.
Now go to those candidates.
Yes.
So they'd get dispersed.
Yes.
So suppose you have one Democrat and two Republicans running in some election for some reason.
Yes.
Right? Well, suppose the Republicans split their votes 30% and 30% and the Democrat got 40%.
Sure.
Well, one of the Republicans who had the fewer number of votes is eliminated.
Yes.
And most of their second choice votes go to the other Republican.
Who then wins.
Who then wins because they have over 50%. Because you keep redistributing these votes until one candidate hits 50%.
Yes. Makes perfect sense.
Right. Now, there are some problems with it.
Sure.
There's some, I guess, weird sensitivity to initial conditions.
Okay.
Essentially. And some counterintuitive strategies. We shouldn't get too much into this.
No.
But we're going to throw it in the show notes. Okay. So you can, you know, go see where this fails.
Sure.
But for the most part, it's an improvement.
Yes.
Because here's what happens, right? Now you go to the 1998 Minnesota gubernatorial election, right?
Yeah. Yes.
You vote for your third party candidate first.
Yes.
Maybe. And then you suppose you like the Republican better than the Democrat.
Yes.
Put that down. Or... you really don't want Jesse Ventura to win.
Right.
So you put the Republican first and the Democrat second. And,
yes.
You know, Jesse third.
Yes.
And that allows you to not waste your vote.
Yes.
Right? Worst case for that last supporter we talked about who doesn't want Jesse Ventura to win.
Right.
They put the Republican first, right?
Yep.
The Republican suppose doesn't get enough votes, so they're out. That's between the Democrat and Jesse Ventura.
Yep.
But... that allows you to not waste your vote.
Yes.
Because you're voting against a candidate you don't like.
Yes.
In a three-way election.
Yeah. And if in that situation, so let's say Republican doesn't get enough votes, if those second-choice voters for those Republicans is Jesse Ventura,
right.
Then he should win. Right. Yes. If those votes flock to Ventura as their second choice, then, yes, he should win. And right. you would also think, under that system, especially third-party voters, people who consider themselves independent. I don't know what the latest number is, but there's a good percentage of the population who considers themselves to be independent or not necessarily affiliate totally with one of the main two parties. I think a lot of those times, we'll call them moderates, right? They feel as though their voice isn't really heard or represented. I mean, I've heard things like 30%, 28% of the voting population. Well, if those people could go into the voting booth, vote for their third party or independent candidate, and then as their second option say, well, this is who I would like if my person doesn't win, their voice is they feel more enfranchised, right? Yeah. Their voice is heard. And we also still get, I think, maybe a list of candidates who feels like they can go outside of the two main parties. Mm-hmm. Right? Because right now, if you want a legitimate shot at winning most, most offices, whether it be state level or federal level or probably not local, but state and federal certainly, you need to buy into one of the two main parties, right? So then you're left with candidates who maybe don't even believe everything that the party stands for, sort of jumping into that party to say, okay, yes, you know, I guess I align more with this party. I'll represent that. And then do we maybe have some candidates who aren't necessarily the most authentic, who are maybe trying to squeeze their circle selves into round or square boxes, right? I think you would just get maybe a more authentic candidates and maybe improve voter turnout in a situation where, okay, I feel like my first, second, and third choices were at least heard, and then we can see where the chips fall. So it's at least worth considering, I think.
Right, and if you bring this system into a full-out system, I guess, what I'm trying to say is if you eliminate primaries the way they are right now and you just turn it into what some states do already, with the primary also being kind of an election, as in if one candidate gets 50%, they win.
Yeah.
Right? In a primary, or like a jungle primary where all the primaries happen together.
I think that just happened in a Georgia congressional district.
He didn't end up getting 50%, but he was close, and that's what he was gunning for.
Yep.
But that sort of thing would allow candidates to be authentic throughout the election.
Yes.
Because they're no longer pandering to the base for their party's nomination and then trying to shift to the traditional shift to the middle for the general election, that kind of thing.
Right, to appeal to those moderates.
Right.
And then it leads to candidates who are explaining policies in sort of two-faced, two-sided ways. Well, I said this then, but, you know, things have shifted or I've really changed my thinking. And it really thinks strikes most voters as inauthentic, right? It just doesn't strike them as true. And most voters, I think, are smart enough to realize what's going on there. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't have to worry about that in a situation where you could just be yourself as a candidate.
Right. So let's talk about what's happened with instant runoff voting.
Sure.
Right? As I mentioned, it's happened in the Twin Cities here. But it's been happening at the local level for a long time, actually.
Okay.
Not widespread, of course, but in certain pockets of the country.
Sure.
Cambridge, Massachusetts, home to two of the world's finest institutions.
Yes.
Since 1941, they've been using instant runoff voting for their 9-member city council.
Wow.
Yeah.
1941.
Right. And as FairVote, a organization that tries to reform the voting process, they point out that there's been, you know, there's been racial turmoil since 1941, for example. But Cambridge has done better than most cities because their people were better represented in their city council.
Really?
Yeah. Mm. And so the idea there is that when you use instant runoff voting for a multi-member group, it allows minorities to get a better representation in the group because it's no longer winner take all, which then allows the majority usually to dominate.
Yes.
But when you switch to this instant runoff voting, it allows the people with fewer votes total to still get a seat.
Yes.
You get a more proportional representation system, which is another type of voting system we'll discuss later.
Sure.
But
sure.
So
wow, fascinating.
Yeah. So the other thing to note is that in the 2016 election, there was a referendum in Maine.
Okay.
That barely passed, and it's still unsure as to whether this will actually result in a new voting system. But Maine voters approved a shift to an instant runoff voting system throughout the state for every election except for the president.
Wow.
And maybe senators, I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
But for the most part, there are a lot of local elections, right? They will all use instant runoff voting now.
Wow. So it's growing. We could say it's growing in popularity.
I mean, there's the saying, right? As Maine goes, as the nation or something like that.
Yeah,
right?
I believe that's a saying. Sure, sure. Let's go with it. Yeah.
So, yeah, we could see instant runoff voting start to spread to some more reform-minded states throughout the country. And, I mean, changing it on a national level is just much harder.
Sure.
But even if you were to change it for senators.
Yes.
You could start to see more independent senators, I guess you could see independent House representatives, too, which is far rarer, actually.
Yes.
It's just harder to run a House campaign.
Yes.
Without being one of the main parties.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, and very interesting, I would say. And just with the idea being, thinking about it in a different way as far as what is fair, right? And rethinking that is probably a healthy discussion, regardless of the system.
So there's another type of voting system. Actually, two more I want to talk about. One is called approval voting.
Okay.
Which is actually kind of easy to explain.
All right.
This might have the lowest barrier to change,
okay,
of the systems we're talking about. This is where you can vote for multiple candidates, actually.
Okay.
And you just, you know, check a box next to them if you believe that they would be okay.
Like, I see.
You are okay with them being your representative.
Okay.
And so it's approval voting because you're just approving certain candidates, right?
Sure.
And the winner is the person who gets the most votes.
Yes.
So it still appeals to a lot of our fundamental notions of democracy, right? That
yes.
the winner of an election should be the person who gets the most votes.
Yes.
But it changes things a little bit because it allows you to vote against candidates a little bit easier.
Yes.
Right? Instead, like if we go back to 2000, you might like Nader and Gore are okay to you, but Bush isn't.
Sure.
You can vote for both of them.
Yes.
And this also allows more moderates to win.
Yes.
Because, you know, somebody's going to vote for Nader and Gore, and somebody's going to vote for Nader and Bush.
Yes.
Right? Nader just got two votes out of that.
Yes.
And it allows third parties to run that way, too.
Well, I think, you know, comparing that to the instant runoff, I think probably you're right where this maybe people can... Although I think they both appeal to people's sense of fairness. I mean, can you imagine too many people having a problem with instant runoff? Yes?
Well, with both of these, actually.
Really?
So I think both systems will see complaints based on, and they have already, on the principle of one person, one vote. Mm. Because some people view this as multiple votes.
I see.
Now, I strongly disagree with that. Agreed. Because you're still casting one ballot, and everyone has the opportunity to do the same thing.
Yes.
Right? So it's really, it is one person, one vote, and I think the legal systems here would agree.
I agree.
But...
but there would be some pushback.
There is. And there's also pushback from the people in power.
Institutions.
Right.
Yes.
For example, Jerry Brown of California, governor,
yes.
Vetoed a bill from... that passed, I think, like, it was bipartisan.
Okay.
Through their state legislature to allow instant runoff voting.
Really?
In their state. Yeah. He vetoed it partly because, I mean, his statement, I believe, was it's too confusing. Hmm. But in a state where Democrats, you know, control everything.
Yeah.
It can make sense why you wouldn't want to change that system.
Sure. Yeah. So let's make a point here. This is not necessarily a partisan issue. It's more a who is in power issue.
Right.
Right. If I, whether I'm a Democrat or a Republican, if I am in power, I don't have much incentive to want to change things. Right.
Right.
As far as the voting system goes, because who knows what could happen. Right. Unless I'm absolutely sure that those changes are going to impact me positively in the voting booth. As far as increasing my influence, I'm not likely to want to make a change. But I think it's all the more important then for grassroots efforts to really push these leaders, our leaders, to do things that represent our interests best, not their interests, right? Because our politicians work for us, and our voting system should work for us, not for the institutions currently in power. And if a voting system is simply a way for people to stay in power, a la gerrymandering or the Electoral College, if those institutions are only in place to preserve the power structures that we currently have, then they are failing, right? If the voting systems that we have should be there to get as many people to vote for the people that they see fit in any given election, and if that happens, then our democracy flourishes, mm-hmm. right? In an institution where it's simply, we just keep turning over the same page, we just keep going with the people who we currently have, that's not a system that works. And I don't think that's a system that most people would say is fair.
And so the last voting system we were looking at here is one called Concordat,
okay.
which is a fancy name for a pretty fancy voting system.
Actually. Okay.
The idea here is you look at all head-to-head pairings. So
okay.
For example, suppose you have a Democrat, Republican, and Libertarian, right?
Okay.
So then you look at who would win between the Democrat and the Republican.
Okay.
If the Libertarian wasn't running at all.
Yep.
Suppose the Democrat wins that.
Okay.
The Democrat and the Libertarian.
Yes.
Suppose the Democrat wins that too.
Okay.
And then the Republican and the Libertarian.
Yep.
Now suppose the Republican wins that.
Sure.
So the Democrat won two of them.
Yes.
Two of those pairings. The Republican won one and the Libertarian won none.
Okay.
So the Democrat wins the election.
So that's an easy example.
It is.
Yeah.
And it gets more valuable when you have more choices.
Okay.
When you're dealing with like 10 candidates, for example.
Sure.
The problem, though, is that when you have 10 candidates, that's like 45 different pairings.
Wow. Yes.
Yeah.
Right. So now we're talking about... so if I go into the voting booth, what would I be seeing?
Well, so some kind of election like that might ask, you know, who wins between this person and this person?
Mm.
Who wins between this person and that person?
Yes.
And it probably wouldn't work for you to rank all of your choices. It might. It depends on how you do this.
Right.
The problem is that you might have A beating B, B beating C, C beating A, but that's also weird.
Yes.
So there's some questions here.
Yes.
But for the most part, I personally like the system the best.
Sure.
Because... I feel like it avoids a lot of those situations that show up often.
Mm.
Like, for example, somebody winning with a smaller amount for various reasons.
Yes.
And so this is one I think that's better explained by having our listeners just check it out online.
Sure.
I'll put a link to a website by Cornell that lets you run this for yourself.
Okay.
I also do want to give an example of a time we've used this before.
Okay.
Johnson, I don't know if you remember or not, but 2 years ago, we had finished the AP test.
Yeah.
Not like we slack off after that.
Of course not.
But we had decided to play something
yes.
during one of our hours.
Sure.
And so we had a list of different games we could play.
Sure.
Right? And the list was like maybe, I think, like six things long.
Yeah.
And so we asked, or at least I think, you asked the class, right?
Yes.
Okay, which would you prefer between A and B? A and C, A and D, B and D, all of those, right?
Yes.
And then we just counted who won the most pairings.
Yes.
We ended up playing Foursquare that day.
Yes. And it worked out quite nicely.
Right.
Yes.
And so the system is pretty easy to use without any computer algorithm.
Yes.
If you have a small number of options.
Sure.
And when you have a larger number of options, now that computer algorithms are available for the most part for almost any kind of tabulation.
Yes.
Now it's pretty doable.
Yes.
And so I think a lot of these conversations that are happening now have increased relevance.
Yes.
Because we have the tools to institute them. One of the complaints that we hear from people against changing the voting system is that it would cost some relatively trivial amount of money.
Yes.
I mean, when I say trivial, it's, you know, a couple $100,000. But sure. For a government.
Yes.
That, you know, it would be changing who was in power, which could have much, much bigger impact.
Absolutely.
This is pretty trivial.
Yes.
And so it is something that can be easily changed.
Well, and you can already see, I'm sure some of our listeners are already thinking of the potential problems, right? So if there are 10 candidates and I need to rank them head to head versus presumably I have to know a good amount about each of these candidates.
Right. So ideally you'd be able to leave the rest of the candidates blank and then not express an opinion about them.
Okay. Okay.
But it does raise some questions that it requires more effort on the part of voters.
Yes. Yes.
But I do think that extra effort would translate into a better democracy.
Agreed. Also, although not in many parts of the country, there are still some pockets of the country I know where voting via computer is touchscreen or whatever it might be is still problematic for some people. They feel like there's some shenanigans, right? There's some conspiracy that my vote's not really being counted. There's something, you know, I hate to say pulling a lever or putting a paper through a machine where there's an actual physical copy that does make some people feel more comfortable, right? To know that if there's a recount, we can actually go back and look at those ballots. Now, how often does that happen? I don't know the answer to that. I don't think too often where they actually go back and look at ballots. But in a touchscreen situation or whatever that might be, it may be a little bit worrisome for some voters.
So here's the problem with instant runoff voting, right? Many systems that use instant runoff require you to have all the ballots in the same place. Mm. So in Maine, when they have statewide elections, it'll require them to carry all of the ballots to a central location and count them there.
Yes.
Right? And that's a problem for a lot of local elections, too.
Yes.
Where computer systems might not be as prevalent.
Yes.
Where, you know, where it's reasonable to count by hand.
Yes.
Doing multiple rounds of tabulation can be very hard, too. So.
Well, and also think about, so I'm just thinking of, you know, a stormy night in Maine, and the votes are in, all of these cars descending upon, vans or whatever you might have, descending upon one centralized location, who's to say there's not voter shenanigans on the way? Who's to say there's not problems on the? What if you know, heaven forbid, a car is in an accident and the ballots are strewn about? There are lots of things that still could happen in that situation with paper ballots. But there is something. There is something to the fact that when I put pencil to paper and I run it through a machine, I do feel. You know, I feel like, well, you know, my vote has now actually been counted and kept and recorded in the case of some kind of a problem with the machine, right? Because how many times have computers, quote, let us down, right? Well, it happens and it's getting better, but there's no paper trail, right? So we're always worried about, well, what about the paper trail? How could we do a recount? There's ways, of course. But I think it's something that at least needs to be thought about.
Right. Yeah. While I think this would be better on average, I think the number of cases where you have real anger about the fairness of the result would also increase.
Agreed.
So while on the whole it's better,
yes.
The question is it worth it for that increased anger from a subset of the population?
Yeah. Well, and again, it also requires a very educated and involved electorate, where this might be something that we get to down the road, right? So maybe it's not the next shift that we make. Maybe we don't pivot to this yet, but after voters have gotten used to maybe a different voting system, maybe they could pivot to this.
Right, and the interesting thing here is that in Europe, these various systems have been used in different capacities,
sure.
And they've spread within Europe, right?
Yep.
So it starts off in one country and certain parts of Western Europe continue to take those systems.
Sure.
And they all have different variants of it, right? We recently saw the French election, which was a runoff at first. The top two candidates get to go off against each other in the final election, right? Yep. There are some parts of Europe that use proportional voting for most of their elections. And so that means when you go to the ballots, right, to vote, you put Democrats as your party, right?
Sure.
You vote for the Democrats. And then at the national level, you count the number of votes Republicans got. Say it's like 52%. Democrats, 45%.
Sure.
So then Republicans get 52% of the seats.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a list of people that they're going to actually put. So they just go down the list and get as far as they can with their seats.
I see.
Democrats do the same thing.
Yep.
And then this allows you to vote for a third party and not have it hurt.
Yes.
Because you can vote for the Libertarians and if they get 2%, they get 2% of the seats.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Everything's proportional.
Yes.
So this is nice for third parties.
Yes.
But the problem is you lose this single member district affiliation that we're so used to.
Yes.
We like having a representative we can go to.
We do.
Right? At least fundamentally that's part of our democracy.
Yes.
Because in this country it's not the parties that represent us, it's the people.
Oftentimes, although we do tend to, I think most people tend to vote for the same parties, which is interesting enough. But we do like the idea that we're voting for a person.
Right. We like to know who we're voting for.
Yes.
That matters to us a lot, even though
we're likely to pick the same party.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And one other thing I want to mention here is there have been numerous times where both Nikhil and I have talked about third parties being sort of underrepresented in our current system. So this isn't necessarily meant to degrade the two parties that we have in power, but I think especially in light of the recent election where many people were dissatisfied with the two main candidates from the two main parties, it's worth at least exploring how do we get third parties and fourth parties and fifth parties maybe more involved in the discussion. Because right now, it's flipping a coin. If Democrats are in power, they want to keep the same power structures in place. If Republicans are in power, naturally they want to keep the same power structures in place. And there isn't, outside of maybe rethinking the way we elect our representatives, it's very hard to get those institutions to move.
Right, and running on a campaign of voting reform is very difficult.
Absolutely.
Right? There was a candidate on the Democratic side this election that tried to do that. And he ended up getting not even 1%, no support.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
And he was running on campaign finance, which is actually a
legitimate issue. Sure.
Yeah, like something that people talk about and try to rally behind, right?
Right.
Proportional voting is not something that gets the base excited.
No.
Right?
No.
But there are realistic solutions that can happen at a grassroots level.
Yes.
And that has to probably happen at the state level.
Yeah.
And so Fair Vote, which we've referenced before and will be in the show notes, is an organization trying to change these things, right?
Sure.
And their solution is multi-member districts.
Okay, so explain that.
So right now, we live in Minnesota Congressional District 1.
Yes.
Right? Which means our representative is Tim Walz. We have one representative, a Democrat.
Yes.
Right? What about the 49% of our fellow voters who are Republican?
Yes.
Or voted for the other candidate, right?
Yes, yes.
They don't have a candidate that represents their views.
Right.
A politician that represents them in Congress with their views. So the question now is then, why do we only have one representative? There's nothing fundamental about us only having one person who represents us in Congress, or three if you include our senators.
Right, right.
I don't see any reason why that's fundamental.
No, I mean, because think about it now. If we take it to the three representatives that we currently have, for a Republican in the 1st Congressional District of Minnesota who has two Democratic U.S. senators and one Democratic House representative, they really have zero representation. Now, you say, well, the senators and the representatives do their best to represent all Minnesotans.
Right.
Okay, sure. Probably some of our listeners are going, okay, slight eye roll there. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, it's fair to say that even though Minnesota is pretty split, I mean, it leans Democratic, but probably no more than 55-45, right? Under the current system. So we're saying probably at most 55% of voting population in Minnesota is Democratic. There could be independents lurking within there, and that goes back to our voting systems and how we think of things. It's probably less than 50% of Minnesotans are represented by or are identify themselves as liberal Democrats, right? And yet, 100% of their senators are Democrats. So to think of it as a congressional district, Minnesota 1, with three representatives, what would that look like under that system? Well, maybe if you rethought of that the voting system that we have, is it theoretically possible to end up with one Democrat, one Republican, and one independent representing us in Congress?
So the big problem here is that we only have 435 seats in the House.
Okay.
Right? And changing that is a lot more difficult.
Sure.
That's a national level thing.
Yes.
But what we can change is how we assign the representatives from each state to Congress.
So, for example?
So what could happen in Minnesota is you'd combine three of the congressional districts. Let's just say, I don't know which ones are adjacent, but let's just say the first, second, and third.
1, 2, 3.
Yeah. Yep. Combine those districts and give them three representatives.
Okay.
For that giant district.
Yes.
Right? So now you have three representatives that are representing a broader area, sure.
Yes.
But still three representatives.
Yep.
And when you go to vote, how this would work would be an instant runoff voting system.
Yep.
That lets you vote and rank your choices, right?
Yes.
So you put, let's just say you put the Democrat first, the moderate second, and the Republican third.
Sure.
Now, suppose this mega district is very, very liberal.
Yes.
Right?
Sure.
So the Democrat gets a lot of votes.
Sure.
Right? So once they hit the threshold needed, and in this case it would be 33%, right?
Sure.
Once they hit that,
yep.
The remaining votes for him,
yep.
Or her, I guess,
yep.
Go to the next candidate that they wanted.
Yes.
So most of those would go to the moderate.
Sure.
Then they get a seat.
Yes.
And then the remaining votes would go to the Republican.
Okay.
Right? And Now ideally you'd have more than three candidates for a three-person race.
Yes.
And so you'd have 10 candidates, and in the super liberal district, you might get three Democrats.
Maybe. Sure. Yep.
Or two Democrats and a moderate, right?
Yes.
But for most districts in the country,
yes.
You're probably going to end up with the one Democrat, one moderate, one Republican.
Yeah, maybe 2-1, 2-1-0.
And the moderate will likely be from one of the main parties.
Yes.
But could very easily be an independent, too.
Absolutely.
And so this would better represent people, I think. And
yes.
It would also let you have a specific person for you.
Yes.
Right? Like, if you identify more as a Republican than you do a member of the 1st Congressional District.
Yes.
Now you can find a Republican from the 1st Congressional District.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
Instead of our current system.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting way to look at it. So, potential pitfalls. What could they be?
Right. So, the benefits here for sure.
Yes.
Are that it reduces polarization.
Yes.
Because of what we talked about. It also reduces gerrymandering.
Sure.
Because is you combine districts, just mathematically, it's harder to gerrymander.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And then it also increases representation in general, as we talked about. But there's data also showing that countries that use this have more female legislators.
Really?
Yeah. So it helps with the gender balance. And it kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
Right? Like when it's a single member, one person take all kind of thing.
Yes.
It just tends to skew toward men more often.
Sure.
But when you can have three seats, it's easier for one woman to win, if not two or three.
Yes.
Right? So it's different. The dynamics are different.
Sure.
The problem with this, as with most other things we discussed today, is that it's difficult to explain.
Yes.
And also, I think it does question something that a lot of Americans consider fundamental, which is one district, one representative.
Yes.
There is one go-to guy, right?
Yes.
Or girl.
Yep.
And the problem here is changing that requires changing at the state level.
Yes.
Right? And that discussion, again, involves the party in power.
Yes.
Having to give up some of that power.
Yes.
Because a state that's gerrymandered their state very well, take Maryland, for example.
Sure.
Right? Why would they want to reduce the number of seats they have in Congress? Because that's essentially what they'd be doing.
Right.
Because if they reduce gerrymandering, they're reducing the number of seats they have.
Yes.
Right? So I think the way you would get to this superior system, in my opinion, is you'd have to wait until more and more states switch away from drawing their own state lines.
Yep.
Following the examples of, I think, California and Arizona,
yep.
They turned over the power to do that to independent groups,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
As more and more states start to do this,
yes.
Then you can see them start to accept this multi-member system.
Yeah, and I think pairing that with changing how we vote at the front end. So,
right.
And really, voters really asking for this and demanding this is to say, we don't want this one versus one. We want, more of a system where I can rank them in order. Because if you can get that on the front end, and then you can get those districts to change on the back end, then you could meet in the middle with both of them, right? But it has to come, I think, like you said, from both ends.
Right, and I think education here will be a big factor and something we just don't talk about.
No.
So I guess my grand idea here is in schools and institutions where you vote on things.
Yes.
Just use instant runoff.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
It's something that wouldn't take that much effort for the person in charge to explain and run. But once somebody's done it once,
yes,
the familiarity with the system really helps.
Yes.
I know I've run some elections where I've used the CIVS thing I was talking about in Cornell.
Sure.
That uses Concordat, right?
Yep.
And then somebody asked me, oh, how does this work? Just explain to them. It's the person who wins the most head-to-heads.
Yes.
Right? And
but there is a certain fear, of course, as with anything, with things that we don't understand, right? So, I don't understand this. I'm afraid of it. So I like my way best.
Right.
And especially something as sacred as voting, right? Mm-hmm. Many people are very protective of their right to vote, rightfully so, mm-hmm. right? We believe in this country that one person has one vote and everybody, you know, everybody's vote counts. And yet some of the systems that we have built up, I think we've, you know, talked about through the course of this episode, could certainly be maybe improved if everyone understood it, if everyone bought into it. Right. So
I think it's instructive to look at what Maine had to do, right, when they passed this referendum.
Yes.
They actually had to go out and educate people.
Sure.
So what they did is they went to bars, for example, and they demonstrated how you would vote between different beers.
Sure.
You know, they said, okay, so you put your ballots down here,
and
then we move them. Right? Yep. And they showed how it works, right?
Yes.
And I think those campaigns, you know, things where you're actually going on educating voters, even if they don't succeed, I think they're important for democracy.
Yes.
Because they make us at least consider the underlying structure.
Absolutely.
Right? Because these voters in Maine probably didn't think about voting theory in general.
No.
Until this came up as a question on their ballot, right?
Yes.
And then they realize, I have the responsibility to vote correctly on this question. Now I need to learn about it.
Yes.
Right? And voters do this all the time.
Sure.
Right? When you vote in the presidential election or this, you know, your state or local elections, you have to learn about the candidates.
Absolutely.
Right? And for some people, it's very easy. You just vote for the candidate that's from your party.
Sure.
Right? That is learning, though.
That is.
Right? Because over time, you've come to the consensus that this party represents my ideals.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
So it's the same kind of learning. It might be a little more academic in nature.
Sure.
But at the same time, it still relies on the same democratic ideals that we have in this country.
Yes. And really, from the beginning, our democracy will, I think most people agree, will function best when we have an educated and literate population who is informed about their choices and picks what represents those the best, right? And if people are willing to, you know, our democracy is ours. We own it. It belongs to us as citizens. If we as a citizenry are able to pick the best system to represent our interests and go to that extra step of educating ourselves to pick those people who support those interests, I mean, all the more vibrant our democracy will be, right? Right. If we as a citizenry take that responsibility seriously, do we not owe it to ourselves to make sure that the systems that we have in place really support those goals? I think the answer is obviously yes.
Yeah. And as we wrap up this episode, I do want to tell our listeners there's going to be a lot in the show notes for this episode. There are some links to FairVote, to a YouTuber that has a lot of videos about this that I think both of us would implore you to check out. They go into more depth as to what the problems are, what the solutions are, and actual ways you can get involved if you feel like this is an issue that, you know, should see some resolution in the future.
Yeah, I mean, so I think it's fair to say the only way it's going to happen is by citizens demanding it.
Right. Right?
And if we have any small part of that, that would be awesome.
Yeah. Right?
That would be great.
And since there was a lot of stuff that we talked about in this episode, we would really love to hear feedback, like
yes,
usual.
Yes, always.
This one, I think, more so than usual, I feel like, because I think we talked about a lot of things.
Yes.
And I'm sure people have other insights or questions.
Yeah.
Seriously, if there's something that didn't make sense, let us know. You can email us at solvingsystemspodcast@gmail.com. This episode in particular, I wanted to thank the people that always help us. Drake Thomas and Ben Durstein, we've had some conversations about this in the past, and it's really at least helped me formulate a lot of these views. We have to, of course, thank Katie Holzer again for editing these episodes. It's a task that actually takes quite a lot of time.
Yeah, so we really appreciate grateful. It. Could not do it without Katie's help and support.
Yeah, so that concludes episode 7. We'll see you back here soon for episode 8.
Yeah, thanks a lot for listening, guys.